Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Harmony? Y'all like Harmony? From Mountain View, Arkansas, Harmony has been playing together for over 30 years and are regular performers at the legendary Ozark Folk Center. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at harmonymusic.org. All right, welcome to a special edition of Tales from the South, a celebration of Women's History Month, where strong Southern women bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at South on Main in the Soma District of Little Rock, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by Temino's Publishing Company and the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops, and tonight's show is sponsored by the Arkansas Women's History Institute, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here playing for us tonight is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here tonight? Y'all like our set? Tonight, we are thrilled to debut esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox's brand new piece, River Bridge, for our Strong Southern Women set tonight. She has prints for sale both here tonight and on her website of this amazing piece. A portion of tonight's print sales goes to Tales from the South. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and VL at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight's show features women telling tales of not only their own lives, but also of those women who influenced them. All stories are true and told by the strong Southern women who live them. Later tonight, the intimidable Mara Leverett chooses to stand up, and we'll end the night with the amazing Crystal C. Mercer and her lineage of strength. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with the incredible Garbo Hearn, learning strength at a young age in early Southern life.
It was a hot and sticky Monday evening as I walked to the corner and entered the door of the side door of Morning Star Baptist Church for the beginning of the week-long revival. I was 11 years old, and that summer, just like all summers in South Arkansas, marked the time of revivals for my Aunt Pearl's church. Summer revival is a week-long program of attending church in the evening, which ends with homecoming and baptisms. I had been to a couple of revivals before this one, and I knew that during prayer, revival attendees are asked to close their eyes, and those who are without a church home or who have never been baptized are asked to raise their hands. Since I was a guest of my Aunt Pearl's and had never been baptized, I always raised my hand. On this particular Monday, however, once prayer began, the guest minister, tall with small, closed-set eyes, changed the format by asking all non-members, he referred to as sinners, to come forward and sit on the front row. Having never been baptized, I was afraid not to go. So I finally got up on shaky legs as the people on the pew allowed me to pass through and walk slowly down the center aisle of the church to sit on the front row. At the end of the sermon, the guest minister stood in front of the four of us who had not joined the church and chided us. His intimidation was so powerful that the other three stood up and scrambled to the area that would ultimately lead to membership and or baptism. I just sat there. Buried in the creases of my mind, I recounted all that I heard about what I would feel at this moment, that I would float toward the warm embrace of the Spirit. I've felt nothing like this. Unable to shed my fear, I was frozen to the spot, knowing deep in my heart that the time was not right. Choking on the mounting pressure, I looked past the guest minister directly into the gaze of the minister of Morningstar Baptist Church, who knew me well, hoping for acknowledgement that he understood my position. Instead, he looked at me and turned his head. I felt as if I had been attacked, and the person that would rescue me just sanctioned that attack. Just over a decade earlier, I was born in El Dorado, Arkansas, on a perfectly calm and sunny spring day. I grew up in a neighborhood called Morningstar. I had a relatively happy childhood. I was the youngest of four and had the luxury of spending 5 years with my parents all by myself. Both my parents were tailors and educators, my mother a second grade school teacher, and my father an elementary school principal. Both belonged to a nearby African Methodist Episcopal Church, and even before the age of acronyms, it was called AME. Although CME is an actual denomination, I jokingly referred to us as CMEs than regulars. By that, I mean that we habitually attended on Christmas, Mother's Day, and Easter. I see my father in his custom-made suit, my mother looking beautiful in her silk dress, and I always had a new Sunday dress that my mother made for me. It always felt right with them. However, the music of Lee Chapel AM in church was solemn, and I found myself falling asleep most of the time. I don't recall having any expectations of any time of feelings about church and what it means. It was more following a program designed by my parents who followed the program of their parents who followed the inherited customs. Having no real idea of what religion was about, I was young, but not too young to notice the politics of the AME church and the class distinction in a place where that division should clearly not exist. Some people were far more important than others. That alone was contrary to the lessons we were taught, but like any other 11-year-old, realizing that most of the world was a giant mystery, I trusted that one day I would make sense of it all, as adults seemed to do with ease. How would I know that it was no easier for those who I watched stand strong and made life problems seem so small? But something was missing. Then there was Aunt Pearl, who lived next door. She attended Morningstar Baptist Church on the corner. If the doors of the church were open, Aunt Pearl was there, no matter the weather. So what made me all of a sudden begin to follow her to church? Duckling analogy. Perhaps it was my confusion, or maybe just curiosity of both. Whatever the reason, there I was, sitting in the pews, noting the differences in ritual, the mood, the musical spark. Having nothing else to go on, I imagined that the liveliness that permeated in that Baptist church was the sole attraction for Aunt Pearl. For me, it was the exciting Sunday school program with moral lessons on the commandments and intriguing parables. The music alone would have been enough to keep me coming back for more. It was free-flowing and happy. The music at the revival was also what I had been looking forward to on that Monday night. But instead, I ended up alone on the front row, the sinner's row, as Aunt Pearl's minister turned his head. I was more confused than ever, but instead of caving to pressure, I ran out the side door, 2 blocks to my home, crying fiercely and directly into my mother's loving arms. She comforted me and told me that I had done the right thing, that I should join church because I feel it, not because someone says so. After a couple of months, I went back to that church, but the magic had worn off and my pre-adolescent self no longer took the minister serious. I went to hear the music, see my friends, laugh and talk with them during the sermon and sometimes when the sermon was over. So later in college, I began studying religion and found that the differences were that people had different names for God, Creator, Allah, Yahweh. Wide spectrums of people believe in the same thing, except the rituals differ. But overall, the ultimate goal is self-improvement and being invited to go through the pearly gates of heaven. For me, church should be as simple as going to the gas station. Any individual should be able to freely and comfortably attend any church. Fast forward 21 years later, I sat with three of my four children, ages 7 to 4, in a different Baptist church, consumed with love and emotion and the feeling that it was time. As I got up this time to walk toward deliverance, all three of my children followed me. The admiring church members must have seen the beauty in this, but would have had no idea that I wasn't in a position to admonish them and ask them if they really knew why they were there. Before the actual baptism date, I made sure they understood. I wanted it to be their choice, their decision. I wanted to pass along to them the power to make their own decisions, no matter what the pressure of what others thought. I wanted to teach by example. And I'm happy to report that all four of us were baptized together.
Garbo Hearn is the director of Pyramid Art, Books, and Custom Framing, Hearn Fine Art in Little Rock, Arkansas. She is married with four children. She enjoys reading, collecting art, juicing, and traveling. Next on Tales from the South, Mara Leverett is told to be quiet. And, well, let's see what happens in a civil rights story that's not about color.
It's hard to overstate how naive I was when I moved to Arkansas at 22 in 1970, but I can give you an idea. I wanted to register to vote, but how? Where? By chance, one day I drove past the building that houses the Arkansas Democrat. That must be it, I thought. Maybe here you register by parties. All I can tell you is that the woman at the front desk gave me one of those peculiarly Southern looks that kindly, pityingly looks at you and says, "Bless your little heart." As fate had it, about 5 years later, I went to work in that building as a reporter. I would go on to work at the Arkansas Gazette and the Arkansas Times, all the while sharpening my focus on the part of government that intrigued me most, our criminal justice system. Case by case, story by story, I learned a lot. One thing I learned is that the Arkansas Supreme Court, which licenses attorneys, established rules for their professional conduct. The rules are published online. Anyone can read them. The Supreme Court also established a committee to make sure that attorneys conform to those rules. Anyone who has a complaint about an attorney's conduct can report it to the committee, which is supposed to investigate. A similar committee exists for judges. Over time, I submitted three such complaints, all about prosecuting attorneys. Prosecutors wield tremendous power. If they abuse it, justice stands about as much of a chance as a turtle crossing a freeway. My first letter to the committee was as fair and factual as I could make it. I immediately received a letter from the committee in response. It was on impressive Supreme Court letterhead, and it was terse. The first paragraph informed me that the office had received my complaint. Then, like a hammer, came the second paragraph. It jumped off the page, all caps and bold, the way that that screaming alien leaped out of Sigourney Weaver. The paragraph warned that I'd better not reveal any information about my complaint to anyone, including the news media. To make sure their message was clear, the committee's letter continued, "Anyone violating this confidentiality may be found to be in contempt of the court and punished by fine or jail." That letter set me off like the 4th of July. A committee of the state Supreme Court was going to tell me I couldn't write or talk about something I told them in a letter and hold me in contempt? Of what? I'm not even in court. And fine or jail? Give me a break. Oh, I had a fine little rant. But in a corner of my soul lurked a sickening fear. I felt 99% certain that this letter was trying to do something fundamentally wrong, something that even I, a non-lawyer, knew, or thought I knew, ran afoul of our First Amendment's guarantees of free speech. To me, the illegality of the letter's threat seemed obvious. Yet the letter had issued from the state Supreme Court. It was confounding, like hearing Mother Teresa curse you to hell. My third letter was about a prosecutor named Tom Cooper down in Southwest Arkansas. He's a judge now. But in 1999, he was his district's prosecuting attorney, and reliable evidence had surfaced in filings before the Supreme Court that when a man named Tim Howard was placed on trial for killing two people in Little River County, Cooper had withheld important evidence that might have persuaded jurors of Howard's innocence. As it turned out, they'd found Howard guilty and sentenced him to death. The committee had dismissed my two previous complaints, but it said it would keep its file on Cooper open until a court ruled on whether the prosecutor had indeed engaged in misconduct by withholding the critical evidence. That happened. A court did finally rule that Cooper had withheld the evidence, a form of misconduct serious enough to get a man sentenced to death. As a result, almost 16 years after Howard's arrest, 14 of them spent in isolation on death row, Howard will get a new trial next month. But did the committee ever act on my complaint against his prosecutor, Tom Cooper? No. And I know now that that should not have come as a surprise. While the committee frequently sanctions defense attorneys and attorneys who practice civil law, you will remember it famously disbarred President William Jefferson Clinton, in the past 25 years, it has never, yea, not once, issued a prosecutor so much as a caution. Throughout this process, I began to wonder whether the court's Committee on Professional Conduct was even serious about all that big, bold print. Or were these empty threats, simple bullying, to stifle public discussion that might hurt some attorneys' reputations and perhaps chances in some future election? So I published my complaints on my blog along with the committee's letters. Thank you. I pointed out that I was still here, not in some grimy jail, and that no one had held me in contempt, not officially at least. Silence was the only response, empty, indifferent, arrogant silence. So far, this had been a personal battle. That changed when my daughter told me what had happened recently to a friend of hers. The friend had written a letter to the state's judicial commission about inappropriate behavior towards her by a judge. Like me, she'd gotten a letter back right away. And like mine, it contained a formal warning to her not to disclose what she'd put in her letter, lest she face fine or jail. The letter rattled my daughter's friend, but it frightened her husband even more. "That's it," he said. "We have a home, we have children, we can't pay a fine, we can't have you put in jail. Forget about that judge and don't talk about this anymore." Now I saw the full, intimidating, silencing effect of this slimy practice. Bullying on a school playground is one thing. Bullying by a state Supreme Court, exploiting the powers it actually holds to issue fines or send a person to jail.
Then there was Aunt Pearl, who lived next door. She attended Morningstar Baptist Church on the corner. If the doors of the church were open, Aunt Pearl was there.
He pondered the matter for some time. With Jeff's help, in 2011, I sued the Supreme Court in federal court for violating my civil right to free speech, especially with regard to elected officials. Suddenly, the court was paying attention. The Attorney General's office represented the committee. In my corner, I had Jeff and the First Amendment. And we won. Thank you. More properly, I should say we settled. After a bit more than a year, an agreement was reached. I would drop my lawsuit, and the Supreme Court would issue an order stating that anyone who filed a complaint about an attorney was free to disclose the content of those complaints. Does the importance of Mara Levert versus Arkansas Supreme Court Committee on Professional Conduct approach that of Brown versus Board of Education? Not by light years. But does it matter? It does. In 2013, a Supreme Court in one southern state, a court that was itself violating civil rights, was quietly forced to stop.
Journalist Mara Levert is the author of three books, The Boys on the Tracks, Devil's Knot, and Dark Spell. Her book, Devil's Knot, was made into a feature film starring Colin Firth and Reese Witherspoon. She is a former board member of the Arkansas Women's History Institute. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, Crystal C. Mercer comes from a long line of strength and stronger because of her.
Lucy? What my meemaw affectionately calls me after one of my favorite entertainers, Lucille Ball. You don't want to be 40-year-old trying to marry and have a family. Do what you need to do, then choose you a husband worthy of your love. I got real close, choosing a husband, that is. I dated this guy named Ronnie for almost 13 years. He was intelligent, good-looking, adventurous. He was everything I wanted. However, as time moved forward, that same time began to push us apart. One day, Meemaw was on one of her marriage sermons, and she asked about Ronnie. We're fine, I quickly responded, trying to shut down further discussion about the matter, but my grandmother wasn't a pushover, and she bulldozed right through my embarrassment. I thought she was gonna rip me apart with, I told you so, and you should have done this, and you should have done that. But, however, what came out of her mouth was a delightful comeback that I carry with me to this day. Now, Lucy, I like Ronnie, I really do, and I know you love him dearly, but Ronnie ain't got no papers. She was strong. Well, she is still strong. Leola strong, to be exact. And after double knee replacement, open heart surgery, and 81 years on this earth, my grandmother is still ticking. Beautiful, she has cocoa skin, make you want to eat a candy bar, pretty pearly white teeth, all her originals, I might add, and eyes so big and brown you can't help but to stare directly into them. She gave those eyes to my mother, and my mother gave those eyes to me. I guess that's how it works, genetics and all. However, I have more than my grandmother's eyes. I have a piece of her spirit, a sliver that is so tenacious, it traveled from the silken shoals of Pelahatchie, Mississippi, and found a quiet corner in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. The eldest daughter of Nancy Olin Osterstrong, Leola was born in the delta of that muddy, mighty Mississippi River in a town that barely made the map. Pelahatchie, not too far from Jackson. Soon after, a few more children were born to my great-grandparents. As the oldest, it was my grandmother, only a girl at the time, who was responsible to help tend to the younger ones and to help out on the farm. Farming was laborious, long hours under the hot sun radiating from the sky, making the fields feel like an oven, baking the blackness deeper into the exposed skin of my kin. They planted and picked cotton, corn, melon, squash, tomatoes, herbs, flowers, anything you could think of eating, wearing, or looking at. My folks were like magicians. Seeds were their fairy dust, water was their powerful wand, and food was their big reveal. Work is noble. A simple phrase my great-grandfather would say. Indeed, it was that. However, it was backbreaking. For any male child to leave the farm, they had to join the service or get a job. Not too many options. However, it was one more option than the female children had. The only way for girls to leave the farm was to get married. Trading in one job for another, most of my great aunties, including Meemaw, all left the farm young girls turned into young wives. My Aunt Juanita was married at 12. Meemaw was married soon after. My grandmother fell for one of the handsomest fellas around, so handsome that he became my grandfather. Towering over 6 feet, Leechester James was quite a catch. Meemaw was only 15 when she married Leechester, 17 when they had their first child, my Aunt Martha Ann. Then came Sharon Kay. Then came Catherine Elaine. Then came the youngest girl and the toughest of the bunch, my mama, Pamela Denise. With four daughters in tow in a three-bedroom house and ends barely shaking hands as opposed to meeting, Lee Chester did what any man would do to care for his family. He went off looking for work. He had siblings in Chicago, so with the support system in place, he started looking there. He figured the family could have a fresh start in a new city. Meemaw was on an opposite page. She had sacrificed so much, leaving Pelahatchie, settling in Pine Bluff, raising her siblings and her own babies. She told him, "I'm not leaving Arkansas. I told you when I moved here that I wasn't moving again." "Come on, Leola," Lee Chester protested. "We need to do this for our girls. What's wrong with our life here? Our families are here. We have everything we need here, right here, Lee. I don't want to go uprooting our children, chasing some job that may not pan out. Now, I already told you, I'm not moving away from Arkansas. This is our home, my home, and this is where I'm going to stay." My grandmother didn't budge. Neither did my grandfather. Sticks in the mud, they stood until finally Lee Chester broke his silence. "Leola, I'm going to Chicago. I need to see what it's like to make more money, live a better life. Will you come with me, please?" Strong in her nature and in her maiden name, when Meemaw said something, she meant it. So in one word, she said what she had to say to her husband. "Bye." That one word funeralized his existence in her life, and their marriage dissolved into nothing. He moved to Illinois, and she stayed in Arkansas. When one something doesn't work out, it doesn't mean that the next something will either. This was the hard truth about life. Sometimes nothing works out and things fall apart. My grandfather did find work, a new woman, a new life up north. However, it was nothing as he imagined. Times were still hard and his family suffered. Meemaw worked two, most times three jobs to make do. And to even the load, she sent my aunties and my mama to Chicago every summer to spend time with Lee Chester. Some years later, she found love again and married the grandfather I knew best, Jerry Brown. They had a son, Stephen Douglas, and life seemed a bit peaceful again, normal even in the midst of chaos. Chaos was no stranger to my grandmother. When she was still a girl in Mississippi, her mama, Nancy Ola, stole away in the night with a man named Jacob Pridgett. She was madly in love with Jacob, left my great-grandfather Oscar with their five young children, and began a new family and bore four children under Pridgett. When the moonlight faded on their love affair, Nancy Ola fell in love with the church and left her newest children to fend for themselves the best way they knew how. Instantly, Meemaw became the matriarch of the family, caring for her eight younger siblings and her own five children. As a woman, her work was never done. However, she always recognized it was her work, her responsibility, and at the end of every day, her joy to love and care for her family. These are some of the lessons she has taught me. Women must be strong, yet gentle, firm, yet reassuring, direct, and yet demure. A woman has many roles to play, and she must play them all as if the Academy hand-selected her for each part. She encouraged me to be like the women in my family and also strive to be better. So when Meemaw told me that day, "Ronnie ain't got no papers," I was a little stumped. You know, the old folks always have these country sayings and sometimes they're hard to follow. I just had to ask. "Papers? What does that mean, Meemaw?" "See, he ain't got no papers. That means if another young man comes to pick you up and take you out, bring you flowers, and Ronnie pull up right behind him, you are just as free as a bird to leave with that nice young man and wave to Ronnie the sweetest goodbye. Cause Ronnie ain't got no paper." Say it with me now. Yes, we bust out laughing so hard. Ronnie and I tried for many years after that. However, he still ain't got no papers. And like my grandmother, who used the least amount of words to end her marriage to Lee Chester, bye, I too use very few words to end my 13-year courtship with Ronnie. Straw, camel, back. I had a new sense of myself. It was time to be the strong woman that I was born to be. It was time to leave the metaphorical farm of a meager existence and a semi-happy life and forge forth with purpose. Meemaw raised babies, loved husbands, and planted seeds not only in the earth, but also seeds of wisdom in her children and grandchildren. I'm proud to say that I am stronger because of her.
Crystal C. Mercer is a freelance performance artist and sole proprietor of Columbus Creative and Safi Custom Homebody, daughter of legendary civil rights lawyer, attorney Christopher C. Mercer Jr. She honors the legacy of her father by fusing arts and activism. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience here at South on Main, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by Temenos Publishing Company and the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops, and tonight's show is sponsored by the Arkansas Women's History Institute. Additional support provided by the Arkansas Arts Council, the Writers Colony at Dairy Hollow, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are open for submissions from all Southerners. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
About sundown, he'd fly to my window and sing. Come take a trip in my airship. Come let us sail among the stars. Come take a ride around Venus. Come take a spin around Mars. No one will see while we're the man in the moon. the man in the moon.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast in Little Rock. More at robinwoodbnb.com. And the Baker House Bed and Breakfast in North Little Rock. More at bakerhousenlr.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at infraredstudioproductions.com. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern-style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.